Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Howard Friel, an independent scholar and author who assesses President Obama's effort to revive Middle East peace talks and the reaction in the U.S. and Israel. Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, who discusses the extraordinary challenges facing the Japanese to control Fukushima's triple nuclear reactor meltdowns. And Larry Gibson, known as the Keeper of the Mountains in West Virginia, who talks about a protest march this June demanding protection for the site of a deadly labor struggle for mountaintop removal coal mining. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Leading global anti-poverty advocates are charging the group of G8 wealthy countries with neglecting its aid commitment to poor nations made at the 2005 G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland. On the eve of the 2011 G8 summit in Deauville, France, advocates are pointing a finger at France, Germany, and Italy for failing to meet their aid commitment, a shortfall of $18 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars. Jamie Drummond, director of the U.S.-based anti-poverty group One, blasted the G8 governments for whitewashing the shortfall in aid to poor countries. 2 years ago in Italy, the G8 leaders agreed to spend $22 billion to boost agricultural productivity. Aid groups say only half of the money for enhanced food production was spent, and there is little information about where the money went and how effective the aid was. Oxfam's Mark Lawson says fulfilling the commitment of doubling aid to Africa could mean universal primary education, paying the salary of 800,000 midwives in Africa, and supplying over 1 million new anti-malaria bed nets. The downfall of International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was indicted for raping a New York City hotel worker, is being felt in Greece as the country struggles to pay off its huge debt. Strauss-Kahn was the leading advocate of Greece's €110 billion bailout by the IMF and European authorities. Athens is under renewed pressure from Germany and other creditors to reduce its debt, cut government spending, and lay off public workers. While at the IMF, Strauss-Kahn, the former French socialist finance minister, put intense pressure on Germany to support the Athens government. The €110 billion bailout of Greece is the largest in IMF history and helped stabilize the euro that went into a freefall last spring. It was seen as the best example of Strauss-Kahn's skills as a financial crisis manager. In his 3 years at the IMF, notes American Prospect magazine, Strauss-Kahn modified the IMF focus from a market fundamentalist mindset based on austerity measures to a more balanced approach focused on addressing high unemployment and weak economic growth. In a recent speech to the centrist Brookings Institution, Strauss-Kahn warned against severe austerity measures that would increase longer-term unemployment. The IMF board will choose a new managing director by the end of June, with French finance minister Christine Lagarde as the leading candidate. Emerging economies like China and Brazil are pushing for a candidate from the developing world. The Federal Transportation Security Administration insists its full-body X-ray scans at airports are safe and only emit minimal radiation. Yet, a group of respected scientists has raised questions about the lack of independent testing of the new scanners. According to ProPublica, the full-body scans are viewed as an alternative to enhanced pat-downs that caused an uproar when a video of a 6-year-old girl getting a full pat-down hit the internet. The TSA stepped up its deployment of full-body scanners in reaction to the 2009 Christmas bombing attempt by a man who hid an explosive device in his underwear. On April 28th, five scientists sent a letter to White House science advisor John Holden, complaining about the lack of test data on the body scan machines. John Sadat, professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco, claimed, "There is no real data on these machines, and in fact, the best guess of the dose is much, much higher than the public thinks." UCSF radiologist Rebecca Smith-Bindman says the radiation from the scanners is minimal, but is concerned that they are not being tested on the same regulatory basis that we see on medical equipment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Ostowski. We'll be right back.
not long after President Obama delivered his May 19th speech addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa, he was attacked for undermining Israel by conservative sectors of the U.S. pro-Israeli lobby, politicians of both parties, and some influential newspapers. Specifically, Obama was criticized for urging Israelis and Palestinians to begin negotiations toward recognition of an independent Palestinian state using Israel's pre-war 1967 borders as a foundation for new talks, the same formula accepted by both Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Addressing the nation's most powerful pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC, on May 22nd, Obama answered his critics by stating that he wasn't calling for the 1967 borders to be central to a final accord, but rather only as a starting point for mutually agreed land swaps to establish new boundaries, taking into account the 500,000 people living in Israeli settlements built in the Palestinian West Bank, settlements which are considered illegal under international law. In a warmly received speech before a joint session of the U.S. Congress on May 24th, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected a list of long-standing Palestinian demands. He vowed that Israel would never cede occupied East Jerusalem as the capital of a new Palestinian state, would not allow the return of Palestinian refugees to their ancestral lands in Israel, and that as a precondition for renewed talks, Fatah would recognize Israel as a Jewish state and annul their recent unity pact with Hamas. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Howard Friel, co-author of the book Israel, Palestine on Record, How the New York Times Misreports Conflict in the Middle East. Friel assesses the chances for new Middle East peace talks in view of the pro-Israel-U.S. political climate that precludes putting pressure on the Israeli government to make meaningful concessions.
Just to say, as President Obama has recently, that he would like to restart peace negotiations along the lines of the 1967 borders, that doesn't really say much. It certainly does not undermine Israel. But there's a lot more to peace negotiations than using the 1967 lines, because using, for example, the Clinton administration's mediation in 2000 between the Israelis and Palestinians, the Israelis wanted to claim anywhere from 14% of the West Bank for its settlement blocks. That was in the beginning of the Camp David negotiations. And then toward the end, the Israelis wanted about 9% of the Palestinian West Bank for its settlement blocks to accommodate about 80% of the Israeli settlers in the West Bank. In addition, the Palestinians, in principle, agreed to some Israeli annexation of West Bank territory to accommodate its settlements, but what the Palestinians wanted was less annexation than 9%, say, and they also wanted a one-to-one territorial swap. In other words, if Israel annexed 9% of the West Bank, then the Palestinians were demanding an equal amount of territory in return, and the Israelis objected to that. The Israelis were willing to give about 1% of its territory relative to the 9% that it was demanding. So when President Obama says that, yes, he wants to restart negotiations along the 1967 lines, that sounds good. It is, in fact, a necessary starting point, but it's not sufficient, really, to describe, you know, the nature of the negotiations, either historically, say, 10 years ago under Clinton, or today.
I wanted to ask you, Howard Friel, a bit about the Palestinian stated goal to go to the United Nations this September and attempt to gain recognition as a sovereign state of Palestine. They have some sympathy and some support from European governments, including France. The United States, under President Obama, is dead set against it and is trying, it seems, to revive these talks in order to head off this UN confrontation. What do you make of the Palestinians' efforts? Is that going to be a game changer? Is that something that can further pressure Israel to make concessions, or will it backfire?
It's hard to say. If the Palestinians, in fact, in September at the United Nations request international recognition of the state of Palestine on the 1967 borders, I think it would have a great majority support at the United Nations. It would, in fact, however, be opposed by the United States. Now, in order for there to be a state of Palestine, there would need to be a UN Security Council resolution to that effect. And in his speech before AIPAC, I believe on Sunday morning, Obama clearly stated that the United States would veto any resolution for the establishment of the state of Palestine. So U.S. policy is very clear on that. And obviously, if we take Obama at his word, the effort in September by the Palestinians to bring the issue of statehood to the United Nations would fail. You know, I think that the Palestinians did follow through on this. I think in a practical sense, it would not result by itself in statehood, but I think what it could achieve if the United Nations supported this, if the UN member states supported this overwhelmingly, then I think politically it would be an important step.
Howard, I wanted to ask you about U.S. politics and how the concerted effort of AIPAC and many politicians and groups that lobby very hard to follow the very conservative Likud line in Israel and not wanting to swap land for peace. How much do you think that will prevent Obama from successfully restarting peace talks?
Yeah, the domestic situation in the United States would be a major obstacle to a peace agreement, a comprehensive agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. Israel, or Israel's current policies, have broad bipartisan support in the Congress, Republican and Democrat. And Obama, in fact, was criticized by both parties in the Congress for the first speech that he gave invoking the 1967 borders. So, you know, again, there are some political realities that would have to be dealt with. It would be difficult to imagine, from my perspective, Israel-Palestine peace agreement, you know, along the parameters of international law, along the parameters of the international consensus on these issues, because the United States with Israel are really the only two states in dissent of this international consensus on what a comprehensive peace agreement would look like. The rest of the world has a very different notion of the Israel-Palestine conflict than we do here. And the domestic political view of the Israel-Palestine conflict here is a major impediment to peace. So that would be, even assuming a good faith effort by Obama, and even assuming a peace agreement, he would have probably major opposition in the Congress to anything that would resemble a fair agreement, in my view.
That was Howard Friel, co-author, along with Richard Falk, of Israel-Palestine on Record, How the New York Times Misreports Conflict in the Middle East. Find a link to Friel's and other related articles on our website at btlonline.org. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, admitted last week that the three failed reactors they operate at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant complex have melted down. According to the utility company, nuclear reactor units 1, 2, and 3, which lost their cooling systems in the aftermath of the March 11th earthquake-triggered tsunami, have had their fuel rods melt, transformed into a highly radioactive molten mass, and settled to the bottom of the reactor's containment vessels. There are indications that some of the superheated uranium fuel has melted through the reactor's steel container and reached a second protective layer made of concrete. TEPCO's announcement has confirmed what many scientists believe to have occurred weeks ago after hydrogen explosions severely damaged three of Fukushima's reactor buildings. There is growing suspicion that the utility and Japanese government have been less than transparent on reporting all they knew about the crisis and the danger to human health resulting from radiation exposure. A New York Times article examining the failure of emergency vents designed to prevent hydrogen explosions at the Fukushima reactors found that a scientist had warned the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission 5 years ago about the flawed system, yet no action was taken. There are 23 U.S. nuclear reactors that currently use the same defective venting system. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arjun Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He discusses the extraordinary challenges facing the Japanese to control Fukushima's triple meltdown and his recommendation that the U.S. and other governments should begin phasing out the nuclear power industry.
One of the reactors, Unit 1, seems to have had a complete or nearly complete meltdown, and the other two advanced meltdowns more than previously anticipated. What is a meltdown and why do we worry about it? A meltdown is the uranium fuel and the highly radioactive products of fission when the chain reaction is going are inside fuel tubes made out of zirconium. And the whole thing is underwater, and the water gets heated up, of course, and you make steam, and that's how you run the turbines and make electricity. But you have to carry away the heat. Even when the chain reaction stops, all the radioactivity is producing a lot of heat. If there's steam in contact with these fuel rods, the zirconium cladding of the fuel tube reacts with the steam and generates hydrogen and more heat. And it becomes a self-perpetuating thing in which you have more heat, more steam, more hydrogen. Hydrogen, of course, comes from the breakdown of water. H2O becomes H2 plus O2. And that's the hydrogen that exploded. And if you have a complete meltdown, it means you have had a complete destruction of the fuel. And now you've got this very hot, radioactive, molten mass at the bottom of the reactor. And apparently in Unit 1, it has burned a hole through the steel vessel. And, of course, if it burns a hole through the concrete, then you can get steam explosions and even more severe releases of radioactivity. We've got a very bad scenario here, not only in terms of releases of radioactivity that have happened, but potential for the future and a very difficult scene for how they're going to fix this problem.
But, Jimmy Makajani, we know that in Chernobyl, they encased the destroyed reactor with sand and soil and concrete in what they call the sarcophagus. What is the way that the Japanese government, TEPCO, will be able to mitigate this disaster and end it? Is there a way that they conceivably can do that at all? And certainly, what's the time frame here?
It's going to be very difficult. You know, the company has announced a stabilization plan for 6 months, at the end of which, or 8 months, at the end of which they're going to have established normal cooling, that is, with off-site power and on-site pumps and some kind of cooling circuit that will not result in periodic releases of radioactivity. But I am a little bit skeptical that they can actually accomplish that. And even if they did, it would be the end of the beginning. Then would come the hard part of how you're going to get these radioactive materials out. I think that they cannot do like Chernobyl for quite some time. The fuel is so hot that if they pour concrete onto it, you're locking the heat in and you have a greater chance of this infamous China syndrome, which, as you said, is not technically accurate, but you're locking the heat in, and then you have a greater chance that the molten fuel may burn through the primary containment and create a steam explosion at the bottom, and you can't really empty that water out. So they may ultimately wind up doing that at some point, but I think it would be much better if they could devise a way to actually lift the fuel out of the reactor as they did at Three Mile Island. But here, of course, they've got 3 reactors and 4 spent fuel pools, and it's going to be an immense and extremely difficult job to decommission these reactors and spent fuel pools where the used fuel is stored.
The nuclear industry before the Fukushima accident was looking for a revival after accidents at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, and certainly this accident in Japan has set back that plan immensely. But there are many in the U.S. government who want to proceed. What would be your recommendation in terms of the pursuit of nuclear power or to abandon it? There are many alternatives that you've written about in your recent book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy.
I really think it is time that we made a decision to phase out nuclear power. It makes no sense to make plutonium just to boil water. I think we're smarter than that, and we know how to do it. We just don't have the political guts. As for these loan guarantees, you know, Wall Street doesn't want to fund nuclear power even after more than half a century, and we should leave well enough alone. I think where we should be going is to create a sensible, steady plan to phase out existing nuclear reactors and store this spent fuel safely, so we're not making more and more of this nuclear waste that nobody really wants in their backyard and nobody knows what to do with. I am convinced that we can go to 100% renewable energy. It won't happen overnight. Take 25, 30, maybe even 40 years, but we can do it economically, and I think we'd have a much more thriving country with much better quality of jobs if we did that.
That was Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Find a link to the Institute on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can download a free copy of Makhijani's new book titled Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. From June 4th through the 11th, hundreds of people will march from the town of Marmot, West Virginia, to Blair Mountain, 50 miles away in Logan County, to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the Battle of Blair Mountain. The battle was the largest insurgency in U.S. history after the Civil War and pitted some 10,000 West Virginia coal miners against the coal bosses and their private army, and eventually the U.S. military, as they fought for the right to join a union. During their march, activists will be demanding protection for Blair Mountain as a National Historic Monument, which would also safeguard the area for mountaintop removal coal mining that is already encroaching on the historic battlefield. Other demands include the abolition of all mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia, national labor solidarity in the face of some of the worst attacks on the rights of working people in 75 years, and sustainable jobs in Appalachia. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Larry Gibson, known as the Keeper of the Mountains for his fierce opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining. Gibson opposes all coal mining, maintaining it destroys the lives and health of people in Appalachia and across the country. He talks about the union heritage of those living in coal country and the need for working people to come together.
I am wholeheartedly in support of this march, encouraging the working stiffs of America to come in and support this march simply because of the most well-known mountain in West Virginia for the battle it held, for the working man to have the right to organize for decent pay for a decent day's work, and health and safety. The term union was the glue that held the family together, but yet that's not the only symbol we have. You know, all the working stiffs of America didn't belong to a union, but they had to struggle the same way and work very hard for a day's pay. So I guess that's why I'm encouraging people across America, no matter what the ethnic groups they are, it doesn't matter. It's just the working stiffs of America to come together for one common cause to save a mountain that gave so much and supported so many people when they come together to fight the battle of life and freedom and for choices that have now been taken away from them. The working man's pay has been cut. They started taking concessions back in the 70s, and they've done gave too much. No more concessions should be given to the corporations, whether it be coal or anybody. The working man has already gave their life, so wealthy people can own more stock in what they're doing. And the working man, all he's getting is a paycheck. And that paycheck is not enough to allow a decent living for these people. Now, in order for the working stiff to provide a living for the family, they have to get the whole family a job, say like at Walmart.
What do you think about the fact that the United Mine Workers Union is not supporting the march? President Cecil Roberts says the union supports protecting Blair Mountain as a National Historic Site, but is not supporting all the other demands of the march.
The people who are in place now, including Cecil Roberts, has this comfortable cushion job because of what happened that day on August 21st, 1921. Because of all these men that had to pay the ultimate price, the United Mine Workers, for so few jobs that they represent, will not come out and support the actual march for a mountain in order to stop mountaintop removal. And as you know, the United Mine Workers have endorsed mountaintop removal, so they won't come out and try to protect and save the most knowledgeable or well-known piece of land in West Virginia because of what they are enjoying today.
A spokesman for the Mine Workers Union actually told me that the union thinks the march is divisive because of its demand to end mountaintop removal mining.
I have been fighting for almost well over 25 years for the abolishment of mountaintop removal. Everybody knows my stand on coal. You know, it needs to be abolished, okay? But during this march, during this week, I will speak nothing about coal or the abolishment of it. What I will be doing is concentrating on saving Blair Mountain and stopping mountaintop removal. Now, if I'm asked my opinion on this march, I'll give it. But at this point in time, it's not about union or ununion. It's about the working man. I am willing to march beside of a union man over on my right and beside of another man on my left that don't have a union card, simply because we're marching for a common goal to save the most well-known mountain in the state's history, and it's called Blair Mountain. It's about trying to save the symbol of the working class, the symbol of the working men around this country, and anywhere else where they got to be sweating and not knowing what they're getting into and not knowing if they're coming home. The working people who have to work and give everything they got just to feed their families, that's all. And this mountain is not asked for anything else. It gave us a reason to fight for before. And so now we should at least give it back life instead of death. In other words, this mountain should be saved from destruction.
Larry Gibson, one of the other demands of the march is sustainable jobs for the people of Appalachia. I thought that meant jobs on wind farms instead of digging coal, for example, that kind of thing. But you have a different definition.
By the meaning of sustainable, meaning life-giving, you can make a living without destroying your own backyard. When you have to destroy your own backyard, that's not life-giving. That's not sustainable. You know, in other words, you still got to try to struggle to live in the mess that you're creating yourself by working for the man that's paying you. If given a choice, they wouldn't be destroying their backyard. Sustainable jobs, sure. Jobs that have quality about them and have sustainability where you can live with and not do the job and end up dying because you're doing it.
That was Larry Gibson, an anti-mountaintop removal coal mining activist in West Virginia and a supporter of the March on Blair Mountain, scheduled for June 4th through the 11th. For more information on the march, visit our website at vtlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at vtlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.